Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it be worth to close the school achievement gap between children with and without economic disadvantages? While historic efforts to help kids reach their full potential have targeted struggling students, a growing body of evidence suggests we might prevent them from struggling in the first place by directing targeted resources toward lower-income children long before they reach kindergarten. Joining us to talk about this are three experts who believe communities can benefit greatly from ensuring that all children have the kind of early learning experiences that families of means take for granted. James Heckman is professor of economics at the University of Chicago and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences. Neil Halfen is professor of pediatrics, public policy, and public health at the UCLA Schools of Medicine, Public Health, and Public Policy. Robert Duggar is a venture capital investor and co-founder of Ready Nation. He serves on the governing board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. All three are in town to participate in the Texas Statewide Early Learning Summit taking place today and tomorrow in Fort Worth, and they join us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with this. What knowledge and skills do children need to develop before they ever set foot in an elementary school starting at the kindergarten age in order to succeed?
Well, we know from a large body of research that there are enormous gaps that appear very early on in the life of a child. And if you start looking at the test score gap, the achievement gap between kids from the advantage and disadvantage backgrounds, measured advantage and disadvantage measured in many different ways, but say the mother's education, is she a high school dropout versus, say, a college graduate or an advanced degree holder, that you'll find that the gaps that are there at the 12th grade when kids are graduating more or less are there when they enter school. And so the schools are not going to play much of a role in achieving. They can play a role, but much less of a role than we used to think. And in fact, what goes on in the first 5 years is really critical. So I would throw that out as a first piece of knowledge that we have acquired.
And we know that the kinds of skills that children need are not just knowing their ABCs and colors, but they need to be able to know how to play with other children, to regulate their behaviors and emotions, and to be able to interact in a relational environment, because a lot of learning isn't just one-on-one, but it has to do with the social relations in a school, with teachers, with peers. So that relational intelligence that they need develops early in the first several years of life, and we need to be thinking about it. All the talk about, not just IQ, but emotional intelligence and social intelligence. Those are all capacities that begin very early in life and things that need to be supported.
What happens, what is the long-term prognosis for a child who is unprepared for kindergarten? Does the gap sort of stay the same, or does it widen as time goes on so that a small gap in kindergarten is a very large one by the time you get up to high school?
Well, clearly, the graduation rates, high school graduation rates, are profoundly affected by, this is Rob Duggar, profoundly affected by whether or not a child is ready at kindergarten. The others have talked about these as social-emotional skills, a sort of social-emotional intelligence. From the business community, we think of these more as executive skills. These are the skills that enable a person to work effectively in a team. If those skills, what we know is if those skills are not in place by age 5, kindergarten entry, they frequently don't appear. We know that addressing them before age 5 works. Forgive me for being sort of dollars and cents about this, but we have in Salt Lake City a case in which a county and United Way and business community have decided to invest about $7 million in expanding pre-kindergarten, quality pre-kindergarten in Salt Lake City by 600 children. These are very low-income, high-economic-risk kids who generally go get assigned to special education, exactly the kind of social cost that we want to avoid by having quality early learning. These kids generally have been assigned into special education, causing the Salt Lake City School District significant additional costs at a rate of about 20 to 30 kids out of 100. What we know with quality pre-kindergarten is that we can reduce that assignment rate to 3 to 5 kids out of 100. That cost avoidance savings, it turns out, is large enough to pay for the pre-kindergarten in its entirety. And what's critically, critically important to your question about, you know, the gap widening or the gap between high achievers and low achievers or just the inequality question in general. What we know about this is that the longitudinal studies from the Salt Lake City research shows that those kids who receive that quality pre-kindergarten education, by the time they get to third grade, they're effectively indistinguishable in their math skills and in their literacy skills from other kids.
And that's without changing anything that's happening at home.
Correct. In a sense that the parents are involved in the pre-kindergarten. Only quality pre-kindergarten involves a tremendous amount of parental involvement. That's crucial. Parental training, so to speak, is a critical part of successful early education, early care, early child development altogether. So it does change things at home in important ways. And what's truly important there, I think Jim would agree, is that the evidence shows that what's done with that first child flows over to the subsequent children. So what is happening, certainly in Salt Lake, is you have a significant expansion of quality pre-kindergarten with a significant reduction by age 8 of the differences between math and literacy skills, and a reduction so large in special education assignment costs of the public school that amount of money is enough to pay for the pre-kindergarten.
Just a couple comments. One is the issue of the widening gap. There is a sort of general phenomena that happens of compounding. So those little differences in little children become big differences as kids get older. And we see that both in education and in health and in mental functioning. So getting things right at the beginning and getting them on track is really important, not just economically, mm-hmm. but developmentally and health-wise over the long term. I think the second issue is that pre-kindergarten or preschool and high-quality preschool is absolutely necessary, but it's not sufficient. And I think what Rob is raising around the parenting issues are really important. We just finished a study that's going to be published in the Journal of Pediatrics looking at the early childhood longitudinal birth cohort, a survey that was done of kids developing in the United States, where we looked at the differences between the math and reading scores when kids started school at kindergarten. And what we saw are two really important things. One is there's a huge gradient. So poor kids do not so well as would be expected, but the kids at 200% of the poverty level aren't doing so great, 300%. So it's a very steep gradient that we see, so that all kids are affected, and the ones at the bottom. So it's not just getting programs for poor kids, but it's really thinking of the whole social gradient. The second thing is that when we looked at the factors that really influence those outcomes, clearly preschool influence, parental education, the like. But one of the strongest predictors of how well kids did had to do with what the parents' projection forward was, whether parents thought that their child was going to go to college. And so if the parent had a vision that their kid is going to go to college, it didn't matter that they were, sort of poor, uneducated. They were managing towards that, and their children did better. So part of this is not just, getting preschools in place, but getting parents with the right kinds of expectation and managing towards getting their kids to there and supporting them in that way. And there are a whole set of new interventions that are being developed to try to help do that in various ways. So putting that full continuum of services from birth to kindergarten, then some, the kind of scaffolding that's necessary to support that development and uncouple the effect that poverty or adversity has on children's lives is very important.
Let me just add something, and that is when you use the word pre-K and people talk about preschool, they're also thinking of school. They're thinking about classroom instruction. They're thinking about teaching, as Rob was saying, the ABCs or the colors. But I think what's really important to capture here is the sense that you're changing the environment of the family and the child together. that essentially the parents are with the child much longer than any pre-K will ever be. And we know from many studies that parents, many parents simply don't have the tools. It may be a matter of finances, but it may also be a matter of knowledge. They simply lack the knowledge that allows them to essentially develop their children in the way that they themselves would like to see their children develop, but they maybe don't know. For example, in some of the work in the Nurse Family Partnership Program, what's being done is actually informing young girls who are pregnant with their first child the dangers of drinking and smoking while they're carrying the child. A lot of these kids don't know it. It sounds surprising. To an educated audience, it sounds unbelievable. But it is truly something well documented, but that's not well understood. So what you're doing is you're giving knowledge, and you're also changing the nature of the interaction between the parent and the child. The kind of scaffolding that Neil's talking about is really this kind of dynamic interaction, and you're changing parenting, and that's important. And that's not say you're not preaching down to kids. What you're offering the parents is kind of new skills, new tools that allows them, enables them to get more flourishing lives for their children. And I think that's important because it's not really school. It's not the normal thing of sitting down and memorizing. And in fact, and this is where you're talking about test score gaps and so forth, I would argue that we really have to think more deeply about what we think of as the gap and what we mean by child poverty. Because child poverty is not just a matter of income. It's also a matter of simply parenting. And that can go across the whole spectrum, which is what Neil was saying. So I think we really have to reconfigure our thinking about the standard questions about what causes us to develop. And it's all common sense. In some sense. It's all commonsensical. But in some sense, we kind of have let the schooling ideas, the formal educational ideas, seep down into the early childhood notions and to think, well, you know, it's a school. It's not a school. And secondly, the test scores that we normally focus our attention on are very inadequate measures of child development. And if we focus on them, we miss a lot of the story.
I'd like to add something to that, sort of, again, another sort of dollars and cents discussion. We know from prenatal counseling of expectant Medicaid qualifying mothers, low-income women, we know that in the one instance where this has been actually carried out in an experimental way, that a quality prenatal counseling program done in southeastern Virginia resulted in such strong improvements of the mother's ability to take care of herself and her child that the reduction in neonatal intensive care costs and subsequent emergency room visits and other infant health care costs, in just the first 12 months, the cost avoidance savings to Medicaid from the prenatal counseling was large enough to pay for the prenatal counseling and probably a bit of a return on investment of anywhere from 10 to 20%. So what this is telling you is that as a consequence of not focusing as we should on that parent or that mother in this case, we end up paying much higher remediation costs, healthcare costs in this instance. But the same is true of child development and subsequent school performance. In the Salt Lake City case, by investing in quality pre-kindergarten, which involves a heavy component of parental involvement and parental education about what the true capacities of their children and what they should be looking forward to, that city, until recently, was choosing to pay for special education at a very high cost rather than simply a much lower cost of doing it right early in the child development and education process.
We're speaking this hour with Robert Dugger, co-founder of Ready Nation, who serves on the governing board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, Neil Halfen, professor of pediatrics, public health, and public policy at the UCLA Schools of Medicine, Public Health, and Public Policy, and James Heckman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Neil Halfen, Professor of Pediatrics, Public Health, and Public Policy at the UCLA Schools of Medicine, Public Health, and Public Policy, with James Heckman, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago and winner of the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, and with Robert Duggar, a co-founder of Ready Nation, who serves on the governing board of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. All three are in town for the Texas Statewide Early Learning Summit, taking place today and tomorrow in Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So it sounds like from much of what we've discussed already that waiting even until a child is a few months old to identify families that could use intervention might be too late.
Right. There's been a big push over the last 10 years of really understanding the need for a two-generation model. And what that means is two things. One is that you need to be thinking about the mother and the mother before she has the baby. So there's been a real focus on preconception, preconception care, preconception development. So the CDC and other government agencies have been really focusing not just on prenatal care, but really thinking even before a woman gets pregnant and what has to happen, you know, to get them in the best shape and increase their reproductive potential, so to speak. The second is that after a child's born, and I just want to mention a study that I think is really significant done by Mark Feinberg at Penn State University. He's done a randomized controlled trial of an intervention where parents before their first child is born get four classes, basically to teach them and help them get on the same page so that they both have the same script about how the child will move forward. And after the kid's born, they have four more classes. And basically, this is about parental alignment, getting them on the same page, and decrease the stress and strain in the household about how kids should be raised. And what they've shown is that the children not only develop better, there's less stress in the household, there's less levels of cortisol and all these stress measures. You have better executive function in the children. But you see out to grade three that you see these children having much better educational outcomes. So this issue of working both with the child and the parents and getting everybody aligned and moving in the same direction seems to be very important.
I will make a kind of supplement to that, and that is some of the early interventions, other randomized controlled trials, which have targeted primarily the child, the young child, usually, have also had a byproduct of promoting the woman's self-efficacy. She's actually much more likely to go to work. Part of it's because the child care, it is child care, it's child development. These issues sometimes are not discussed together, but they're intimately related. So it's child care. And it facilitates the woman working, and at the same time, it seems to empower her. So you see higher wage growth, higher employment. So there really is a two-generation effect that seems to be coming out of these. And we hope a third-generation effect when children of these early interventions themselves are parents. The data are just coming in, but there are some hints that something very good is going on when these people, who themselves were born at a disadvantage, have gotten the intervention and they become parents themselves.
Yeah, it makes me think about the fragility of like first generation middle class families. They're so much more likely to fall back into poverty, even if mom or dad has gotten a college education. And I wonder if that's because they sort of succeeded despite not having those interventions, and maybe don't have the same skills that they would have had otherwise.
Well, it may be something that Jim just pointed out that is critically important. Tim Bartik, up at the Upjohn Institute in Michigan, wrote a book a few years ago on investing in kids for regional economic development. What he basically showed is that investing in kids prenatal to five increases per capita income in a region as well or better as any other economic development strategies, sports teams, infrastructure, corporate parks, tax subsidies, whatever you want to talk about. And the first reason is that quality child care immediately increases the productivity of the parents. That is a point Jim raised. Child care quality pre-kindergarten, certainly the early interventions, prenatal, pre-parenting, that Neil mentioned a moment ago, are going to strengthen the parent's ability to cope with one of the most difficult challenges in modern society, which is to raise a family when both parents are working. Given the skills being taught how to cope with this, it intuitively is clear that this would be an enormously important capacity for parents to have. And so, in a sense, what Jim and Neil are saying, what Tim Bartik documented in a sense in his book, is that equipping parents this way and providing the capacity for those children to be well cared for so that anxiety levels and stress levels are down and parents can be more productive adds to economic growth. And we can clearly see that if indeed this is happening and parents are equipped the way they should be, the children are going to go to school better prepared, and they're going to perform better while they're in the K-12 system.
Well, let me jump in here because all of that sounds perfectly logical. Everything that you have said sounds like it makes sense. But in terms of finding funding to pay for these things, mm-hmm. It's sort of easy to convince taxpayers that if you're going to teach kids, you know, ABCs, or you're going to make sure that they are, you know, reading on grade level, people sort of understand that. This, although it seems like it has, results that have been proven scientifically, they sound like soft skills to people, and they sound like things that might sound like giving resources to lower income people that are not provided by, you know, federal dollars or state dollars to middle class people.
Well, I mean, there's a sense. I mean, you had several aspects to your question, and I would say I would focus on the soft skills part of it because that by itself can be a killer. People say, yeah, it's touchy feely and so forth. I recently have written several papers and a recent book on just this very question about the hard evidence on soft skills, and I would just direct you to a new report issued 2 days ago by the OECD, which is the same organization which in the past has promoted the so-called PISA scores that rate nations in terms of quality of schools and so forth.
We don't do so well on those.
Yes, we don't. But it turns out that they admit now, and I was at a conference with education ministers who essentially extolled this, that there was hard evidence on these soft skills. These soft skills are very predictive of workforce productivity. And in fact, in a recent survey that I read in anticipation of this visit from the Dallas Fed, showed that one thing that employers were complaining about mostly was that, you know, soft skills were lacking in their workers, the ability to show up on time, the ability to work with others, these things that we think are kind of touchy-feely. A, we can measure them. B, they're important. And C, we can see that employers are saying everywhere, whether it's in England, whether it's in the U.S., anywhere, that these things are very, very productive. And they're very predictive of many important life outcomes. I think that's important. But the other thing I would add is that and this is another part of your question, people don't yet appreciate the interlinkages among these different aspects of human development. See, the point is
– You silo them all.
You silo them. You think, okay, I'm going to look at test scores. And that I think, is a killer to every understanding. Early interventions have tremendous effects. We recently published some papers in Science, and there are lots of body of work now showing how the promotion of these soft skills, promotion of self-control, self-discipline, as well as education, knowledge, leads to tremendous improvements in adult health at age 35. Okay, so what you're doing is you're reducing the burden on the healthcare system at age 35. And what initially was thought to be an educational intervention to boost the IQ of disadvantaged children. See, so there's something missing here. It's these interlinked systems just beginning to be fully understood. And I think that's the challenge to public policy. But if you want to talk about saving money down the line, you know, whether it's in early education, preventing special education, or whether it's reducing healthcare costs or reducing crime, you look at a number of dimensions. This is the core of basic capabilities that are promoted by these programs. And they percolate across the whole life cycle, across many aspects. And that part isn't understood, that we are really some basic core capabilities shape us. And if we lack them, we lack the capacity to engage life. If we have them, we can engage many aspects. But I think so far public policy has not recognized that. I'm talking too much, but I think this is an important point to throw out.
And I think that there's just a play upon the point that Jim made. When people go into a low lifetime trajectory because they start off, you know, behind the curve, you know, what we're talking about, you know, by age five, if kids are losing 20 or 30% of their mental capacity just because it hasn't been nurtured in the way, they're going to go into a long-term lifetime trajectory that's going to be lower. By the time they're 50 or 60, they're going to have a whole bunch of health and chronic health conditions, and it's going to cost society a huge amount of money. And if we can get them into a higher trajectory early on, they'll go into a much more healthy and lower cost trajectory for society. When we look at our country versus other countries in terms of the differences in expenditures in the healthcare system, why we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world with the worst results, it has to do with not just what we're spending at the end of life and paying for failure. It's because we don't invest for success early on. And when we look at these other countries, they're spending much more on social and educational programs to have the scaffolding that we need. Now, why don't we have the scaffolding? What's going on in our country? Because we have growing inequality. It's not just the poorest kids, but 200%, 300%. We're starting to see the ladder of social mobility. The rungs on those ladders are getting further and further apart, and parents are working harder and running faster and spending a whole lot more of their own resources on things than we have ever before. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Why is this going on? Well, one of the reasons, and this is a pediatrician sitting next to an economist and a finance expert, but one of the issues has to do with, for you know, a century ago, life expectancy was about 45 or 47 years of age. Now it's 80 years of age. Over the last century, what have we done? We've basically built the scaffolding for people to get old in the country. So we put Medicare and Social Security, and we've put all kinds of flow of capital towards the end of the lifespan. And that goes not just into the social programs, but in the way our mortgages work and the way our retirement system works, and for the white belts and white shoes that have to be, you know, for guys that are going to play golf when they retire. And so there's all this money that's flown towards the end of the lifespan. And now we have a time in history, for the first time in history, we're going to have more older people than younger people. And so we have this sort of macroeconomic issue of flow of capital in one direction. And what we're doing is we're starving the seed corn at the beginning of the lifespan. We're not investing enough early on. And so we really need to stand back and sort of say, from an overall standpoint, how do we really put in place a 21st century scaffolding that's whole child, whole family, whole community that needs to be in place so that we get these high trajectories and we see these returns on investment, not just over the short term, but for our whole society over the long term?
To underscore what Neil is saying, let me just provide two data points, and they underscore and also what Jim pointed out earlier. A study done by the Defense Department in 2009 found that about 60 to 70% of kids, young adults, 18 to 24 years old, could not qualify to be a United States Army private. They couldn't qualify because they hadn't graduated from high school, they had some sort of health issue, they had some police record, and in some instances they have some persistent drug dependencies. Well, these reasons effectively meant that more than 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds can't get a job, say, driving a truck for a commercial laundry. This is an enormous loss of human capital at exactly the time when Neil is talking about the society getting so much older. Well, one of the reasons that these kids have these
and
issues
the demand for skills
is going up. Exactly. I was just going to get to that. This demand for skills is going up. So we have, in essence, a human capital shortage that is building in our country. In Virginia, we know what this human capital shortage is. It's within about 5 or 6 years, we have hundreds of thousands of jobs that we can't fill. New York State has done a similar study. I expect the workforce boards here in Texas have done a similar study. And I wish I now had done a little work and look at that to see what the projections are for workforce shortages over the next 10 to 20 years in Texas.
It's pronounced because the boom. Texas is a booming state.
I would expect that to be the case, which means that failing to educate those parents to cope with modern life and how to raise kids from prenatal months and take care of them in their infancy and get them ready for school, get them into pre-kindergarten, how to pick the best daycare centers and all of that sort of stuff, all these sort of parental equipping skills that provide children the health, and executive capacities they need to basically graduate from high school, okay, to get them on a trajectory. Now, you mentioned the political problem. Where do you get the money? Well, the money is going to follow the fact that the value of youth human capital is going up. That's why Ready Nation is finding it increasingly easy to get businesses people to be members and to speak out in support of investing in kids prenatal to five. We have a CEO council of about 100 people. This is the business sector recognizing that, like everything else in economics or everything else in sort of business, what you do at the beginning affects everything that follows, and fixing it later sometimes is impossible. So you have to scrap the whole thing, like a 747 that didn't have a wing that was quite designed right. Whatever you do at the beginning affects everything that's afterwards, and trying to fix it later costs much, much more. So it makes so much economic sense to provide that prenatal counseling, to improve that first 12 months health experience. The child that feels healthy in the first year of life, when some of that brain development is occurring, is a child that's going to feel much more confident and much more trusting and capable. And that's going to feed into year two, into year three, into year four or five. And as year by year, it aggregates into ultimate child success, high school graduation, getting a job, and filling the workforce gap that is clearly, certainly building in Texas.
But let me just raise a point.
We're going to take a quick break, and okay. I will come right back to you in just a second. My guests this hour are James Heckman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago, Neil Halfen, professor of pediatrics, public health, and public policy at UCLA, and Robert Duggar, co-founder of Ready Nation, who serves on the governing board of the Institute of New Economic Thinking. All three are in town for the Texas Statewide Early Learning Summit taking place today and tomorrow in Fort Worth. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with three participants in the Texas Statewide Early Learning Summit, James Heckman, Neil Halfen, and Robert Duggar. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And Jim, you wanted to follow up on something that we were saying right before the break.
Well, it's just a question about why isn't this more widely adopted, these kinds of policies. There's a lot of emerging evidence in biology, in economic rates of return, in terms of the responses in education, and many, many aspects of human performance. But I think it's just a public policy aspect. And it's not just – we're talking about ISIS in Syria. We're talking about a lot of crises. People don't want to act until they see a problem emerge. Prevention, which can sometimes be far better than remediation or response – is a harder thing to sell. And I think it requires probably more documentation, and it's a little more subtle argument. I think that's why it falls on deaf ear in public policy. We can arrest a felon at 18. The felon's committed a crime. We should put the kid away. We should try to rehabilitate the kid. That's something everybody understands. But to understand that at age 3 months, you can prevent a person from becoming a felon, that's an indirect link. And people don't fully understand it. The evidence is pointing in that direction, and there is pretty solid evidence that targeted interventions can be very effective. But it's still something that isn't fully appreciated in public policy, and it just has to be addressed. When people do dollar and cents arguments, you say, okay, we want to spend money on the prisons. Just on the reduction in crime alone. So we've been talking about, you know, early special education, but you can go back and point to crime. The reduction in crime from promoting these early childhood education is enormously effective.
So what are the challenges to assessing the effectiveness of these programs when, you know, something that an intervention that might start, you know, prenatally is not going to absolutely bear fruit or not entirely bear fruit for, you know, 20 or even 30 years?
So that's a metrics issue and measurement issue. And part of that has to do with the kind of measurement and metric systems that we have in place. And we need new and better measures so that we can do that. Clearly, people will invest, even if it's a 1% or 2% return over a long term, if, in fact, they know they're going to get that return, so that we have to have those metrics. Many of our metrics that we use are kind of rear view mirror metrics that tell us 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So coming up with better and different metrics are really important. And also metrics that start to look not just individual child by child, but looking at whole communities. So one of the things that has been pioneered in Canada and Australia over the last several years is measuring the development of children at a neighborhood level, taking it at an aggregate, so you can sort of see how your children's emotional, cognitive, social, language development, physical health is. And there are 9 cities in the state of Texas right now that are doing the same thing, using something called the EDI, the Early Development Instrument, and they're measuring kids in their neighborhoods and being able to say, oh, this neighborhood versus this neighborhood. Look how our kids are doing, being able to see the social gradients, see where you need to be able to put resources, how you target things. So part of this is having the right kinds of metrics and being also to measure not just an individual child, but looking at whole populations of children and being able to measure those trajectories over time. So those are all sort of things that are emerging right now, and you in Texas are actually moving some of this forward, other states aren't. So you should be proud of that.
Wait, there are two aspects to that question. One is the fact that there may be delayed payment, which is true. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a delay. That's one of the benefits, actually, that it actually covers over the whole lifetime. But when people have accounted for that in studies, there are studies that do follow for a long term. I've been engaged myself with others who initiated these studies in following two interventions, one that started in the 1960s, one in the early 70s. The children are now going to be 50 years old and 40 years old, respectively. And we look at long-term benefits across a variety of different measures. So it's not like this is pie in the sky. And these were very coarse interventions. This is kind of like relative to what we now know, we could do a much better job. So these, I think, are lower bounds. But talking about rate of return, you can actually find that there's a 7 to 10% rate of return on this early childhood work. If you look at what the upfront dollars were and what the lifetime payouts are through age 40, just through age 40, that's a substantial return. And those are things that would stand the test of Ted Cruz. It would stand the test of anybody because it accounts for the fact that some of these monies are raised by taxation. Taxation may distort incentives. Even that 7 to 10% figure takes that into account. So the point is there is hard evidence on this, and it's not just pie in the sky. But also the new work is suggesting that we have even better measures that we can actually go forward. So anything we do can only improve on that kind of return.
Can we assume, though, that pilot programs, however successful they are over, you know, however many years or decades, very often they are run by people who are particularly passionate about these ideas and have really bought in. Can we assume that we can scale everything so that we can provide these kinds of services in an affordable way universally, or should we expect there to be some hiccups?
Well, I think just sort of speaking again from a sort of businessman's perspective, we have examples of where the payoff is realized from early interventions. So those are indisputable. The key is data. And at this point, the country does not invest enough in data. In the course of the conversations, you've asked a number of complex questions about political support, about the availability of these interventions for middle-class kids, as well as low-income and moderate-income households. When you look at the business sector's need for citizen-ready, job-ready 18-year-olds or for 24 coming out of college, but young adults who are ready to work, When you look at the business sector's need for these people, you invest in all kids. You find a way to invest in those kids and their parents as needed in order to be to maximize the workforce capabilities of those kids when they're young adults. You can't imagine an economy without young adults. So when you're in a situation in many respects like what you are now, where more than half of the young adults are not going to be employable in a modern society, they don't have the skill levels. This is simply, from a business standpoint, a necessity to rethink what Neil pointed out, the problem that too much capital is going to the seniors, not enough to youth human capital development. What Jim is talking about is you've got evidence from specialized programs, you know, the distinct programs. It's in much the way that people say, oh, Perry Preschool or ABC Darien doesn't matter. It's as if it's to say, oh, we didn't.
These are the pilot programs that Jim was talking about.
Yes, exactly, those pilot programs. It's as if to say, oh, we're not sure we could actually get a device to another planet because we've only have one example. Now we have two. We have one where they put a device on a comet, and we repeatedly got some devices on the moon. But those were special programs. Those were limited programs. No, those were absolutely eye-opening events.
Prototypes.
And what they show is
prototypes.
Prototypes.
Yeah.
They show what is feasible. And what Jim is saying is absolutely correct. Like the moon landings, those programs that he's talking about show what is possible.
But also, there's a sense in your question that I think is incomplete. There are examples of successful programs that have been implemented on a large scale, and they do show benefits. Maybe not at the tune of 7 to 10%. There is an issue of degradation. You may get people who are less inspired, but there are programs in place. And I'd even throw on the table some of the recently emerging findings from the Head Start study that's been heavily maligned, mm-hmm. are showing, actually, when properly reanalyzed, that there are real benefits from Head Start, even though Head Start's got warts and we know there are many ways to improve it. So I think there is an example of going to scale, and there are plenty of programs, not just in the U.S., but in developing countries where people have gone to scale and they have seen long-term benefits. So it's not just a question of a few ideal programs.
But the question you raise, do you have to be a super charismatic hero and have, you know, a few friends that are millionaires or billionaires to fund your program in order to make it successful is a good question. And the Perry Preschool Project and Abbasa Darien and a bunch of these other pilot programs weren't designed to scale. And we know a whole lot more now about what it takes to actually design to spread and scale and how you do that and how you use collaborative networks. There are a whole set of skills and techniques that have been developed. And those are being employed more and more,
right.
And it's being brought across
right.
sectors. So you're bringing sort of spread and scale technology into the basic design of how you're putting a program in place.
And they're being evaluated
and they're
in many
being,
cases
right.
successfully, showing successful interventions
right.
from
so
the same prototypes.
And these apply across, in a way, across all income levels.
So and what we're seeing now, so take a city here in Texas, in San Antonio. There has been an enormous set of innovations put in place for young children. But San Antonio now is working with Tulsa and Hartford and other places that are similar to it and trying to learn from each other so that they can spread and scale mm-hmm. to other cities. So this transforming early childhood, the community systems work that's going on in San Antonio and in Hartford and Tulsa, Cincinnati and parts of Los Angeles, they're all learning from each other and they're starting to scale up and sort of seeing what are the things that can do that. So part of that is putting the innovation platforms and the spread and scale platforms in place and to support that kind of activity. We do it for sure in the technology sector. Mm-hmm. They create roadmaps to innovation. What we need is a roadmap for innovation for early childhood and not just think it's going to be taking these, you know, one or two programs and that's going to do it. We need a long-term roadmap that sort of says, okay, this is what the private sector can do. This is what the technology sector can do. This is what the public sector can do. And in 5 years or 8 years, this is where we want to see our nation at, the same way we would do it in other sectors and use that kind of smart business innovation sense and bring that to bear here.
Now that works. We have seen there is learning that's taking place, as Neil has talked about. Ready Nation published a paper in 2012 showing that pre-kindergarten could be used to reduce special education costs, and lo and behold, the special education cost reduction might be large enough to pay for the pre-K. We did a paper just released a few weeks ago showing that prenatal counseling can be done, and the cost reductions and improvements in infant health are large enough to pay for the prenatal counseling. Now, these are, to use Jim's term or your term, these are pilot projects, so to speak. But what's happened is we have 21 states now looking at scaling up pre-kindergarten for at-risk families and paying for it to a significant degree through reductions in special education costs. We have at least three states looking at prenatal counseling, to scale up prenatal counseling, which is in essence a form of scaling up effective parent, maternal parent training. Scaling it up so the mother is healthier, the infant is healthier, reducing those Medicaid costs, reducing burdens on taxpayers, and improving the first year of a child's life so it is already on the right trajectory from day one. So the learning process is happening. It's quite dynamic. And indeed, this summit, your two-day summit here, is evidence of work that Neil and Jim and I have been involved in for the last 10 years. We are delighted to see it. We're seeing this happening all across the country. So things are happening.
And there's also, you know, just play upon this a little bit more. The Federal Maternal and Child Health Bureau is taking the early home visiting programs and some of these other programs and basically using these industrial innovation and improvement, you're working with the MIT Innovation Lab, mm-hmm. working about how to spread and scale yes. up the maternal infant home visiting program across the nation. So they're using state-of-the-art innovation and improvement techniques, and then they're using it here in Texas and across the nation. So there are, you know, we need to be looking forward. There's a lot of stuff happening to allow us to spread and scale this. We need to encourage this more. And there needs to be more of the technology world and industrial world coming to work in the early childhood space, because we have a lot to learn from some of the techniques that have been used in these other sectors.
Where available should we make these programs compulsory, or should this remain the decision of the parents who would be affected?
We may differ about this. I don't believe in compulsion in this particular area, and I think the reason is, and this is something we haven't talked about,
and I'm just going to tell you we have about 20 seconds left. Oh, I apologize.
Okay. And I would say choice. You want to engage the family. You don't want to sort of impose. The early life of a child is still the province of a family. All of this work has to engage the family. It has to be voluntary. It has to be something the family sees to their advantage.
And I'll just add, in the last 20 seconds, that when you do make a choice and you make it known, you will find parents beating a path
correct.
To your door.
Right. Correct. Correct.
But you have to make it universal in mm-hmm. a sense.
Yes.
You have to make it universal availability so that people can take advantage. And it shouldn't be a hero's journey to get those programs. Parents don't need to crawl under barbed wire in order to get to the program.
But with a sliding scale.
Neil Halpin, James Heckman, and Robert Duggar all are participating in the Texas Statewide Early Learning Summit taking place today and tomorrow in Fort Worth, and they joined us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.